Okay. I'm recording this session. This is not to be threatening or anything, but I plan to, because if I might well post this. If you go to my website, at my university website, you'll see a lot of my audio lectures posted there, and so I do record them from time to time. I hope to speak for about 30 minutes. I have my my watch here, but who knows. But I do want to open the period for questions, because I think this is a really interesting topic, especially one to bring up in the context of younger people. This has to do with the future of humanity, what the human means, and so forth. And the enthusiasm that exists today for the idea of a transhuman or post-human future. Okay. The way I posed the title of my talk, if you looked at it closely, you'll see I said, you know, how is it that we can be talking about a trans or post-human future when we really aren't fully human yet, right? That there's a sense in which, you know, we live in a very privileged position here in the developed world, but still we're talking about two-thirds or three-quarters of Homo sapiens that still live in very substandard conditions, and it's not at all clear that those are going to be elevated or raised to an appropriate level of talking about, you know, living a decent human existence in the near future. Yet there is all of this enthusiasm for trans and post-human possibilities in this context. I mean, so let's say we had intelligence on Mars and they were coming down and trying to do an anthropology, you know, what are we up to in Earth? And they say, these people are just full of false consciousness. You know, they think they've already accomplished humanity by the terms they've defined it, let's say in terms of the, you know, Universal Declaration of Human Rights, United Nations, or any of the sort of standard enlightenment statements about what it is to be a human being, or any of the, you know, sort of especially within the monotheistic traditions about the human being created in the image and likeness of God and having a dignity that should be accorded to that sort of being. That, as a matter of fact, on the ground, we're only talking about a quarter to a third of the human population that actually lives that way by any stretch of the imagination. Yet we're already talking about going to the next stage. And we've been talking about it for a while now. I mean, and the interesting thing about the period in which we live is that this discourse, which in the past was very much part of science fiction, you might say, or even seen as, if you sort of look at the sort of animal side of this, because the science fiction side is mostly the idea that has to do that in the future, our humanity will be booted up in some way through some sort of technological enhancement, okay? But of course there have been others who've said that, you know, humanity is a species that will be superseded in some sort of biological fashion by a species that is more conducive to the planet as it normally is and naturally is and so forth. I mean, all of those things in the past have either been seen as science fiction or fantasy, but now are very much part of the political agenda. I'm not saying they're exactly mainstream part of the political agenda, but certainly, if you know, the key thing to always look at when we talk about politics is to look at what is it that the younger people are attracted to. Okay, even if the younger people aren't the ones who vote in elections, and that varies from country to country, nevertheless, you want to look at what is it that interests them. What is it, you know, where are they deriving their values from? How are they projecting their futures? And from that standpoint, it seems to me that we can talk about a large percentage of the educated, developed, potentially powerful people in the world basically having sort of moved out of a thinking in terms of humanity to something like transhumanity or post-humanity. And I think this is kind of an interesting development. It's an important development. It may or may not be threatening. I don't know. You know, I mean, I think it's an open question. But I think it's very much there on the table today. And I think, in a sense, we ignore it at our peril. Okay. Now, what are the signs of this, you might say, at an empirical level? Well, one of the things that is very striking, I was in Delhi last week, in the Indian Constitution, there is a clause that Nehru was very keen to have put in there about the fact that it is a duty of every citizen of India to cultivate the scientific temper. Okay. And obviously this has not been completely fulfilled in India, but to a certain extent it has been, right? I mean, Bangalore, you think about places in India, you know, and of course in the physics community, there are pockets where that has been fully realized. Okay? But other places where there's not, and there's been a lot of cultural conflict within the country about that, and part of the reason of having this conference was to rededicate this kind of idea. Now, one of the interesting features about India, which the New York Times wrote about a couple of weeks ago, was that there is more mobile phone penetration in India than there is in the United States. I know, right? I mean, what's going on there, right? And one of the things that I think is interesting about it, because when I was in India, I actually asked some people, because they were familiar with this phenomenon, and I said, now let me see if I got this right. I bet those people who are using the mobile phones in all those villages and places that don't have clean water and secure food and all the rest of it, I bet they're not actually trying to get that stuff remedied. And he said, you're absolutely right. They're talking to their friends. Right? It's about, so they're using the social media kind of in the way that we here would use the social media. Okay? Now you see this kind of phenomenon, really, again, maybe I'm going to appeal to the older people in the audience here for this one. Because there was this guy way back in the midst of time, known as the 1960s, called Abraham Maslow. Okay, and this was the guy of self-actualization. And he was a neo-Freudian psychologist who was very important in the late 1960s. And he talked about a hierarchy of needs that human beings had. Right? And the whole this idea was predicated on the notion, and he presented it as kind of a pyramid, right? And there were these basic needs, right? And the basic needs are the needs that are biological needs, right? And so there's a big, broad thing. It's needs that you might say we share with other living creatures. Secure food, secure water, blah, 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 right? And then you go up the pyramid, and then you know, gradually, the beings that need the various other things higher up are these more special beings, you know, until you get to the individual human realizing their individuality. Very sort of romantic kind of conception, okay? That was what Maslow was about. Very sort of important notion in the 1960s. In a way, it was almost like the theory of the 60s, you might say. The self-representation of the 60s. But the thing I want to draw your attention to is the fact that it presupposed that in order to be getting at the higher levels, you have to have the lower levels taken care of first. Right? Right? And so when you look at things like, you know, declarations of human rights and things like this, you know, one of the things that are very prominent in those kinds of documents is the dignity of the body, right? And the security of one's conditions and all of these things that relate very directly to the biological side of the human condition. And of course, you know, at a certain level, we can understand that and so forth. But one of the things that I think we need to think about now, especially if we imagine that the trans and post-human future is a real possibility, is that in a sense, people who are born as Homo sapiens, aren't necessarily primarily identifying themselves with their bodies. Right? So in other words, because this Maslow idea presupposes, you know, in a sense, we're sort of jacked up animals. Right? Because at the basic level, we're animals, and we have to have the animal thing taken care of. But then, unlike other animals, we have to have other things taken care of. But what if you imagine that the idea that you're an animal is kind of just a contingency? Right? That what really matters is the higher stuff, no matter what the physical embodiment is. And no matter how long it is, or whether you're individual or not individual. You see what I mean? And I think that there may be a sense in which there is that kind of worldview developing now. Because to a certain extent, a lot of the information technology and communication technology has made enormous success around the globe, much more so than the kind of traditional ways by which we try to enhance the human condition by, let's say, raising standards of living, you know, in that sort of UN way. Okay? And I think that's a very interesting kind of, you know, proposition, because what is it that people exactly identify with when they're talking about their, quote, humanity? Is their humanity, you know, associated with, you know, whether they have clean food and water, you know, and whether they're afraid, you know, don't have to worry about diseases or things like that? Or is it rather my ability to communicate, to express myself, to get in contact with others as far away as possible, whatever, by some sort of action at a distance means? And I'm thinking that perhaps the latter may in fact be more compelling than we may have been given credit for, and that to a certain extent those two things can be disentangled from each other.
I mean, I was very struck. In October 2010, The Economist magazine, they do these debates on The Economist magazine every now and then. They're very interesting. And one of them was, what is the most significant innovation of the 20th century? Now, there's a lot to choose from. Okay? Now, the interesting thing was that the two that were on offer was the computer versus the artificial fertilizer. Okay? Now, let me make just one parenthetical remark about that, is that nuclear energy wasn't one of them. Now, when I was a kid, that would definitely be on the table. It might have even been seen as the main one. Okay? So I'm talking about, when was I a kid? 30, 35 years ago. Okay?
Before computers.
Exactly. Right. So the point is, the nuclear thing wasn't even talked about, but put that aside for one moment. Let that, sort of set in the back of your mind. But the difference between the computer and the artificial fertilizer. Now, there are very stark distinction there, and it relates to what I've been talking about, because the artificial fertilizer, in a way, is the obvious choice if what you're concerned about in terms of enabling large numbers of people to live long, healthy existences, regardless of the conditions in which they find themselves, because you're able to enhance the environment that in a way that enables you to produce food and so forth. Okay? So in a sense, that you might have thought from that standpoint, if in a sense you were thinking from the standpoint of if you want to have a human existence, you have to have secure biological conditions for humanity, then the artificial fertilizer should have been your choice. Okay, but it lost 3-1. It lost 3-1. Okay, this is The Economist magazine. This is not a tabloid. This is not, we're talking about the high end of general intellectual culture. So insofar as you want to give credence to any of these kinds of polls, this is an interesting point, the computer. And of course, the obvious things that people cited about the computer was the fact that the computer, enhances your ability to communicate, to think. I mean, there's all this enhancement stuff, which is very transhumanist, right? So in a sense, you get a sense people are operating with the assumption that the human being as we are now, we're not a finished thing. We're not a thing that, in a sense, even the best version of it is already available somewhere in Europe or America or whatever. But rather, we are a kind of potential that can be sort of developed in a certain direction. And that certain direction, may involve, discarding or neglecting other aspects of our current being. Okay? Because it was very interesting that an argument, the people who wanted to argue that keeping lots of human beings alive in decent conditions so that they can live to a decent age, that was the burden of proof, was to show that was a good thing. Right? Because aren't you just creating more environmental problems down the road? Blah, blah, blah. Okay? So the artificial fertilizer people, trying to make their strongest argument, right, ended up getting all of the slack. You see? Now that's kind of interesting, right? Because in the classical idea of what, when we talk about the project of humanity, okay, and in fact, I think that that's the most intelligent way to talk about humanity, to be honest with you. I published this book at the end of the last year called Humanity 2.0. And it's basically about this kind of crossroads that we find ourselves in. The thing that I make about the point about humanity is, of course, everybody always has granted that humanity is an incomplete project as it stands now. All the defenders of that, as well as the opponents, have granted this. Okay, so it's not like we believe we've got it all figured out, because nobody ever denies that there's a lot of room for catching up, there's a lot of room for improving situations, inequalities, all the rest of it, and also not really getting the ideals straight in our own minds, even in the places that are seen to be advanced. Everybody grants this point. The thing that's being questioned now is whether this ideal is worth pursuing at all. Okay? And in a sense, Humanity 2.0 is about, in a sense, saying, well, this kind of, fetishizing of living conditions, like how many years you live, likelihood of getting certain kinds of diseases, infant mortality rate, all of these things, these aspects of our humanity that are tied very directly to our biology, that in a sense, we might want to not use those as the crucial indicators of whether humanity, in some sense, is being advanced. Now, that's when we get to Humanity 2.0. Okay. So it does. So in other words, we don't necessarily measure our advancement in terms of whether we have as many people living as long as possible in a way that's sort of like what a first world person lives like. Once you move away from that ideal, which is kind of the ideal that the Enlightenment, you might say, was promoting, and certainly development policy was very much moving in that direction, and I think, God bless him, Jeffrey Sachs still believes this. Right? That's why, you know, Jeffrey Sachs is one of these amazing people, right, who can command enormous audiences and no influence. Right? Right? Because he's basically a preacher at this point. Right? Because there's a sense in which the politics have moved completely away from taking for granted that the ideal he's espousing is the one that people are going to be going for. I mean, I'm afraid to say it. I'm not one of the believers. Okay? I'm one of the people who, you know, who came of age when this kind of idea that he promotes all the time, he gets enormous audiences, you know, but no influence. And I think that's kind of an important thing. We have to kind of be straight about where we are in history, because, you know, one of the interesting things about being a human being, of course, is that people make all kinds of claims about things, but the important thing is always to go back to where are we now in history with regard to all these things people are claiming about where humanity is going? And I don't think we're going in a direction that is going to ultimately realize what Jeffrey Sachs wants. Not at all. Okay. In fact, the way I see things at the moment is that we're going to go into a position where the value of people living long lives in all parts of the world and so forth will be, will become less important. And in a way, people in the West are the ones who really need to be convinced of this. Because I think the people in the developing world, in a sense, they're not as imbued with all of this Enlightenment ideology that we have, that they're not so caught up in the project of humanity in the way that we've defined it. You know, so in a sense, they're more open-minded about the kind of life and the kind of beings that they are than we are. And that, I think, is an interesting position to be in, okay? And this is why I think that for those of you out there who think something like, you know, Abraham Maslow's self-actualization thesis is kind of right, right? And, you know, and that the whole world sort of should aspire to that, where everybody has secure, you know, water, secure food, right, are able to live to a ripe old age, and kind of the way they want, and so forth, that you're going to have to fight for that. That's going to be seen as increasingly inconvenient as a goal for life on the planet. Okay? Now, I don't know how many people are really strong. I mean, Jeffrey Sachs is strongly committed to this, but I don't know how many other people are strongly. I mean, he's of a certain generation. He's only 5 years older than me. Okay? So, you know, of a certain generation, so let's say, you know, people 50 and older still have this view in mind because they were brought up in it. But people 50 or younger, it's not so clear. It's not so clear, okay? And so, because there are lots of other kinds of models of how the future can be, which don't involve increasing everybody's life expectancy and all of this. For example, we have obviously the sort of ecological model that's been around for a long time and has gained more and more credence, and in a way, part of it, you know, is a legal political credence that it's been gaining with regard to the animal rights movement and things of that sort. Namely, you know, we want, you know, various kinds of, we value diversity in the world, not just within the human condition, but in the world in general. And it provides that diversity, we have evidence for thinking that it provides a kind of ecological balance that enables large numbers of beings to live, coexist in a way that is relatively in balance and not causing problems all the time. In which case, we need fewer human beings around, and we need to be more mindful of all the other creatures to the extent that we need to incorporate their existence and their ways of being into our laws and into our political situations. It's a notion that when I was a student, you know, so Peter Singer is kind of the trace you follow here, right? Peter Singer, when I was a student, was seen as completely crackers, okay? He was seen as a very extreme part of ethics, right? Had he not got a degree in Oxford, no one would have taken him seriously. But now he is arguably the most influential public philosopher in the world. He holds a chair in values and ethics at Princeton. Okay? The world has changed, and that's one possibility. The other possibility, of course, is the absorption of people increasingly in information and communication technology. Because one of the ways in which you can show that there has been this enormous value change that's taken place in human beings is the amount of time, you know, where do they spend their time? Are they spending their time actually interacting with other flesh and blood human beings? Okay? I mean, on one hand, you got, you know, you have the situation, just to put to connect it up to the previous thing about the animals, right? Increasing single-person households, if there's any other being there, it's a pet. So it's not really a human being. So there's some sort of intimacy, whatever, emotional life or whatever, but it's not necessarily with another human being, it's with a pet. But the more interesting, to me at least, is the fact that is all the time people spend on in cyberspace. Okay? The amount of times through which your life, your being, your identity, the things that matter to you, meaning, is being challenged through information and communication technologies. More than ever before, people form all kinds of deep emotional attachments. This is the kind of thing that the ethnographer at MIT, Sherry Turkle, has written for 25 years about, especially with regard to children and how they developed this very early on. And I think it's very much, you know, so if what it is to be a human being has something to do with how human beings spend their time, then the virtualization of human identity through information and communication technology is part of the issue here, right? And as it were, you know, there would be people, and I wish sometimes there would be polls that would be much more straightforwardly conducted on this, where people would trade off years of their biological life for certain numbers of months in certain kinds of virtual activities on the internet. Okay, to establish some kind of exchange relation there. Because I do think that increasingly you're finding more and more people getting more and more meaning in that fashion. And so, you know, part of the thing about digital curation that we talk about and all these other things related to information and communication technology has to do, I think, not just with translating and transcribing the works of humanity that we want, you know, people who don't read books but only look at screens can figure out, right? But we also are trying... in a sense, to sort of rethink what our identity is as beings. That we, if we want some legacy, if we want some sort of, you know, where do we remain after we're gone biologically, we want to remain somewhere identifiable in cyberspace. It's like absorption into the Borg, you know, if you remember the Star Trek thing, right? I mean, there's a sense in which that you're getting a larger number of people of the younger generation thinking in those terms. Right now, they don't necessarily theorize it in those terms. I'm not saying this is the kind of stuff people are talking about over beer, right? But it is the kind of thing that I think that, you know, if you look at their practice, if you look at their behavior, that's kind of what it suggests. Because one of the things that we're seeing now in the developed world is we're seeing a reemergence of a lot of the kind of, you know, obesity, diabetes, heart disease, you know, all these kinds of, you know, which are basically diseases that are re-arising now in the developed world because people are neglecting their bodies. It's not that they don't have enough money or enough access to medical care or something like that to prevent those things from happening, but that in a sense, they just don't care. That's not where the action is for them. Their being is not in their body. Their bodies, you know, they're just fueling their bodies to keep on plugging into the internet. And so, not surprisingly, those diseases that we thought had been conquered in the middle of the 20th century are back again. Now, you see, that is an interesting identity marker. Okay? Because where do people, you know, where is the value in your life? Well, it's not necessarily in just keeping your body, you know, in the perfect form forever. No, it's being able to just continue functioning in this interface life. Okay? And indeed, I believe that we might end up getting to a point where all of this preoccupation about the human body and the physical body and all this will become kind of an aesthetic preoccupation. It'll kind of move out of the realm of medicine and become this kind of niche marketed thing. Once we get sort of used to the idea that yes, you know, we will tolerate people dying at the age of 45 from obesity. You know, as long as they live long, you know, as long as they've lived productive lives in front of the computer, you know, in the time that they were around. Right, so you might have a kind of social welfare argument to the extent that, you know, what matters is not that just people live indefinitely in their biological bodies, but if they can do everything they need to do, you know, in a way that they find fulfilling in the amount of time that they're in their biological bodies, let them expire afterwards. Why not? Why not? You know, why not allow that as a possibility? You see? And this would change entirely the way in which we think about healthcare and medical coverage, and I've brought a lot of these kinds of issues I've talked to you about in the context of the reform of the National Health Service in Britain. Because, of course, you know, in a sense, these kind of straitened economic times is a brilliant opportunity for rethinking fundamentals. Right? Because, in a sense, you know, you don't have a lot of money to throw around for welfare, and so that is the moment where, in a sense, what really matters? What should we cover? What do people really want to have covered? And I think, you know, we should reevaluate, you know, because I'm all for the welfare state, but if we're going to be operating from some tighter budgetary considerations, then we have to think about, well, what exactly are the goals that we will be wanting to pursue? And this idea of trying to keep people alive and having all of these health programs to keep people going and things like this and forcing people to lose weight and all of this kind of stuff, is this not fighting an uphill battle that's not worth fighting? That in a sense, we are talking about moving into a different space about how humanity is being defined. Okay, now I say this as someone who runs every day, and I'm kind of a body Nazi and things like this with regard to physical fitness and things like that, okay? That's how I stay the way I do. But I'm saying, I think this is going to become an increasingly minority niche thing. This is not going to be something, you know, and I don't see why there should necessarily be government policy forcing all this, right? So we need to reconceptualize what welfare is, because welfare has to do with maximizing, right, happiness, right? Bruno's here. I mean, but you know, some sort of happiness, some sort of welfare, well-being, and we have to sort of figure out, well, what exactly are we talking about? What constitutes that? Okay? And typically it's been understood in a way that could be aggregated. So in other words, what's good for you individually is something that, in a sense, if we added, you know, could be good for the entire society if we add all the individuals together. So it has to be of that kind. But where it comes from, you know, may involve people living shorter lives and whatever. And I think we really do need to think that. And so in a sense, the business about a transhuman and post-human future isn't just about, you know, whether we move, you know, we start getting extra extensions in our, you know, in our bodies and things like this, that we turn into different creatures that are unrecognizable. But it actually has to do with the relative value that we give to the kinds of activities that we're already doing. Okay? So, for example, and I'll close on this because I want to open it up to questions, that there's an interesting distinction to be made between the transhuman and the posthuman in this context. Because the transhuman is basically about extending human qualities without presupposing that the way they've been embodied so far is the best way to embody them. Okay? And I think the transhuman idea really feeds off of the theological idea of humanity, right? So human beings are these wannabe gods that are stuck in animal bodies. Right? If that's your idea of a human being, which I think is a very kind of theological idea of a human being from the monotheistic traditions, the Abrahamic traditions, right? We are creatures created in the image and likeness of God. We are fallen in a way, fallen gods in a way. And the thing is, part of what salvation is about is to recover, you know, our entitlement. Right? So in a sense, the animal side of us is what drags us down for fully realizing what really makes us what we are, which is to merge with the divine. Okay? If that is your view, right, then you're going, the transhumanism is for you, because transhumanism is about identifying those features of current humans that, in the sense you believe, deserve to be amplified, magnified, you know, and you're willing to pay the price, right? In other words, you're willing to say, if you want a creature that is maximally rational, right, or you want a creature that can do certain kinds of things that human beings can already do, but only imperfectly, but you want them to do it perfectly, then you've got to move into a different embodiment. But it can be done, but you have to move to a different embodiment. So all the fascination with androids, for example, right, that continued, you know, that of course began a long time ago, actually, you know, with Golem and all of this in Jewish theology, but continues to this day, is about that, right? Where you identify certain kinds of qualities that you think, you know, that in a human being is not perfectly realized because we are held back by our biology. Something else can do it. The singularity, all these singularity people that follow Ray Kurzweil. Uploading consciousness. Why do you want to upload consciousness? Not simply to preserve it, but to maximize it. Right? And in a sense, a human being in the biological form that exists today is just in a transitional state, but it's a transitional state to a future right, that we have some control over. Now, post-humanism is different in this regard, because post-humanism does not presuppose that human beings like us, with our value system that we might want to project on the universe, are in control of the show. Post-humanism is, in fact, quite agnostic and typically skeptical about the idea that, let's say, we could control evolution. Right? There's one way in which you could, you know, the original coinage of transhumanism in the, you know, in the middle third of the 20th century by Julian Huxley had a lot to do with eugenics. Right? Because obviously one, so Julian Huxley, a geneticist, is imagining, right, if you actually understand the way in which genes interact with the environment to produce traits, that if you actually do fiddle with genes a bit, you might get the right people. You might just do that. Right? And in a sense, we are the first species ever to be in a situation to even be able to contemplate that. And so Julian Huxley believed that part of our sort of cosmic responsibility is creatures. And he's trying to make this argument entirely within the realm of biology, that in a sense, the unique thing about human beings is that we are the first creature who understands evolution. And so we now have cosmic responsibility to make it, you know, to reach its kind of culmination. And that's what transhumanism was in Julian Huxley's terms. So eugenics was part of his niche. It wasn't about robots or anything like that, or androids, but it was about eugenics, okay? And so he was kind of the happy face of eugenics. We know the other not-so-happy face, but he was the happy face. He was a very positive supporter of that kind of view. And he thought that was what, from a biological standpoint, made human beings unique, okay? So transhumanism, the point I want to emphasize is, it is focused very much on humanly relevant values that we believe that we cannot realize in our current human form. And we need some other form. Whether it be better genes, or maybe we have to go from carbon to silicon altogether. Right? I mean, the point is you're going to have different arguments about that. But the point is, the humans define the value system. Post-humanism puts that off the table, right? For post-humanism, it's much more like Darwin's picture in a way. Right? Where in a sense, species come and go. We're just one of them. And then there's a sense in which, by fixating so much on our own values and trying to promote them as much as possible, we are, in a sense, the ecological crises that we suffer from today, okay, is in a way symptomatic of the kind of hubris that comes from thinking that we, as one among many biological species, right, should be calling shots on the whole cosmos, okay. And so post-humanism is very agnostic about whether we should be projecting human values in this kind of way that the transhumanists talk about. Right? So post-humanists are often, you know, they kind of like the fact that animals are able to get around the world in ways that completely befuddle human beings, you know? And I think that this kind of thing is another aspect. And to be honest with you, I think a lot of that kind of post-humanism, you know, which often is dovetailing with the environmental movement, is, in the end of the day, misanthropic. Right? It kind of blames humanity for all the problems that exist on the planet and the world and so forth. And in a sense wants to diminish the distinctiveness of humanity. It's not anti-life. There's nothing wrong with living. But there is something wrong with trying to imprint everything with humans. To leave a human print everywhere. That is the problem. Not living. Humans can live. The problem is humans can't live quietly. Humans live too loud. Okay? And that is the view of the post-humanist. Alright? And I do think that this is a view that is very popular. I hear some people say amen here. You know, I mean, I think there's a view that has some resonance with younger people. I don't share this view. I'm much more on the transhumanist side than the post-humanist side if you force me to choose. Okay? Because I actually do believe we're creating the image and likeness of God, I'm afraid. Okay? But I do think that this is kind of the issue that is on the table right now for us. You know, especially for the future terms. Because, you know, what do you want to make of humanity? What are you legislating over when you're concerned about human beings? Okay? Should we be worried about the fact that people do not have, you know, secure water and secure food around the world? Well, you should if you think about humanity progressing in a certain direction. But if you don't have that overall view, then that is really not important. And I think that's one of the, you know, in a sense, people have already been voting on that issue. And that's why it is so hard to actually meet development goals. Because to a certain extent, people don't believe that anymore. They may have believed it when I was a kid, but they don't believe it anymore. Okay? And so I do think there's some very difficult value issues that we need to be more straight about and more open about. They're not science fictional. They may have some science fictional roots, but they're ones that I think will matter a lot, you know, increasingly in terms of the rationing of welfare services and medical care and things of that sort in the future. And, you know, I would, you know, a place like this, Zeppelin University, all you open-minded people with all these open-ended disciplines that you're involved in, I would have thought this is an ideal place for keeping the discussion going on a matter like this. And I'll stop here and take some questions. Oh, boy, I love the questions. Yes, sir. We'll start with you.
Okay, so my grandparents are in their late 70s, and from time to time I visit them, and it's like I'm this messenger from a different world, and they bring them all the news. And one time I mentioned massive multiplayer online roleplay games, and especially my grandma's mother, she got really curious because she has problems with her hips. And she kept asking questions, and now she's gone to a point where she basically says once she'll be immobile, she'll start playing those games because they'll give her a way to keep on living a life that she couldn't have otherwise. So what I'm thinking is, are we heading to a future where, because like the half-life of human beings are getting shorter, where it's acceptable to say what I've done with my physical life at the age of 40, and then I go somewhere else where I might be happier because of something I cannot have in
the exactly. See, that's exactly what I'm talking about. Yes, yes. So forget about, you know, hip replacement research or any of that stuff, right? You'll just stop that, right? You'll just stop that beyond a certain point, and you'll move into this other space. Yeah, exactly. No, but you see, that would be a kind of radical shift in the way we think about things. But I do think that that is on the table, that should be on the table, actually. It is interesting to see the response, but I think that is a serious thing. That is a serious thing. You and Max. I'm going to deal with the younger people first, if you don't mind, but I'll get to the rest of you. Yeah.
Shouldn't we also see the other side that, for example, Second Life died off? Facebook is losing users.
But Twitter's on the...
It's not sustainable. It's not making money. It's a thing that probably won't survive.
This is the thing you say, it's not sustainable, but when you said sustainable for a nanosecond, I thought you meant ecological, but you meant capitalistically.
Right.
Okay. But that's an important point, because now we can be saying, if it was ecological, we might be screwed, but if it's a capitalistic sustainability, then there'll be some clever people, perhaps at this university, who'll solve that problem. No, seriously, necessity is the mother of invention when it comes to capitalism. And I think all you're talking about is a problem with capitalism. But look, it's not Second Life as a brand that's interesting, right? It's just the sheer amount of time people are spending in the cyberspace, you know, spending the time defining their identities in cyberspace, all of the efforts, even at the academic level, in terms of having digital curation and things like this, where people are beginning to realize you've got to start putting all the stuff in the old media into the new media. Look, I mean, there is a move being there. What you're talking about are just temporary setbacks. But the direction, the overall direction is toward people, you know, medializing themselves. That is the overall direction, it seems to me, unless you really disagree with that. Second Life as a thing may not survive, but there'll be something else. Yes?
You mentioned we get into a fake reality after we've done our productive life here.
Well, this is what this gentleman was suggesting.
Yes, this is what he was suggesting. I was thinking about more the digital life taking over the first part of our life, so we make experiences. So what do you think, how far are we away from making, I don't know, leading units in World of Warcraft as some professional experience? Example.
No, I agree. Well, look, I think first of all, you're making a good point because the example he was raising was of an older person plugging into the new world. But you're talking about, as it were, someone who's young, who's sort of entering into this world, and that might be their professional experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, the World of Warcraft. Well, as you may know, there is this training academy. You may know about this actually in California for potential officers in the Navy and the Air Force. Which is all about video games. It's a kind of video game-based university for the military, where people are hired to actually train potential generals and admirals and things like this, you know, in terms of how, you know, using, you know, state-of-the-art 3D whatever video games. Okay, and that will be their experience on the basis of which they will get commissions to fight wars and get stars and things like that. So that's already happening within the military in the United States.
California.
What?
I mean, the German Bundeswehr is running there. I mean, my son is a pilot in the Bundeswehr. They're doing that. Exactly.
Yes, so the point is, it's already here.
Some European innocence. That's not only
okay, okay, no. But it's already here, right? It's already here. It's right in the military.
It's everything bad.
Baudrillard's essay, you know, that the Gulf War never happened, this thing that from the 1992, right? What he was referring to was something like this, right? Where, in a sense, the whole war was conducted virtually, right? In the sense that, you know, it was all kind of prefigured on the screen and then executed. Right? And the way it was represented to you as a viewer was pretty much as they had prefigured it. And of course, if you know, and as time goes on, if that becomes your natural reality, that'll be for you warfare, right? So you won't even worry about the fact that you're not seeing people being killed on the ground, right? That, you know, you'll just want to see what does it look like, you know, in a screen level from the way you normally encounter it. So I think the military, as it has been in so many things regarding science and technology, is way ahead of the curve on this. But I do think it's gonna it carries on. So it's already here, what you're talking about. Yeah.
What do you think, well, the actual transhuman thing is going to? I mean, you mentioned Ray Kurzweil and the CUW movement, and if you also look at the Silicon Valley people who work on human augmentation, I mean, where's actually this whole thing doing?
It's going in many different directions. In a sense, I don't see it as going in a coherent direction at all. And, I mean, I think the only thing that one can say for sure is that, I mean, I think the very fact that there's so much money and interest being put into the idea of somehow moving out of the body in the traditional sense is very interesting in its own right. It goes in many different directions. So, you know, Kurzweil says we ought to go from carbon to silicon, but then there are other people like, you know, Aubrey de Grey in Britain. I don't know if any of you have heard of this guy, Aubrey de Grey. Who's very much about saying that we are on the verge of unlocking the secrets of how to switch genes on and off that would enable us to live for 1,000 years. Right? Because there's a sense in which, you know, the ways in which genes switch on and off is determines how we end up, you know, our cells breaking down and so forth and we become old. But that in a sense we might be able, just as we can reverse genetically certain kinds of diseases, that we might be able to reverse the whole aging process in the not too distant future, and so he's imagining we could live for 1,000 years, right? Now that's a totally different way of thinking about this transhuman thing from Kurzweil, right? Because Kurzweil believes that, you know, Kurzweil has no particular attachment to the body in that sense, whereas, you know, Aubrey de Grey is kind of imagining people living the kind of lives they've always been living, but now living it, you know, 5 times longer than they have in the past, right? So you've got different sorts of visions, as it were, of what transhumanity might look like. And of course, if you put eugenics back into the mix, where you can kind of determine people from birth in some way, that then you've got a whole lot of different transhuman futures on there. But my only point in this talk is that transhumanism is very much part of the normative agenda generally. So in other words, there's a sense in which the old kind of view has been abandoned, that somehow, before we move anywhere, we have to take care that all the poor have secure water, secure food, we've got to be worried about what's happening in Sudan, Uganda, whatever. Right? That's been abandoned. And now we're kind of moving into this other space where, of course, there are many other possibilities, right? And there's no convergence on that yet. Yeah. Well, wait a minute, let me go. You've already spoken. Let's now move to the older people.
Well, the old person in one college I can't help was very scholarly for this interest. I was happened to read on the on my flight here just before we met that it is certainly for the Heidegger's essay on each sentence God is dead.
Uh-huh.
And while you were speaking, you know, I thought it's an interesting way, the way you described the post of transhuman could be an interpretation of the Nietzschean will to power.
Yes.
Of
yes.
In a way, because I mean different from the way it has been tragically understood in Germany. Radicacy associated, it is about growth, intensity, and transformation. I mean, it translates werden with transformation. And actually, I mean, this life in the cyberspace would fulfill all these predictions.
That's right.
That's an interesting way of relating it, not giving more or less credit to Nietzsche, but it is an interesting interpretation. So that's the will to power.
Yes.
That's not the will to power in the political sense that we were meant by this. My real question is about the status of not only your own discourse, but of the reflection we are performing here. So you were saying at some point I was waiting for that or didn't know, and I agree with you that somehow, well, you were attributing that to the post-human camp, so to speak, to the position. You say, well, you know, that's evolution. Humans are just one transitional thing on the planet or the universe, and, you know, if you go bunkers, who cares?
Right.
I mean, why would we care as long as we haven't accepted to go to tonight? Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you're performing the reflection you have, being skeptical, as I think you are, about any possibility of having a political influence. You will not persuade Mr. Cameron, I'm not persuading Mr. Obama, and even if Stefan Jens is close to the Kanzler, then I don't think it's going to change much. So what is the status of the reflection we are having? Is this a vanishing side noise? I mean, does this type of reflection belong precisely to that enlightenment type of human that you were saying is now vanishing? I agree with you. You know, is that something that at a new university like Zeppelin will still, I mean, we'll be the last to keep talking this way. And once we are gone, that will have disappeared. I mean, would that be absorbed, so to speak, in this not philosophical position of this is evolution, but in this kind of lived evolution, okay? That's what it is, why should we care about it?
I guess
you're not, I'm not provoking you to be pessimistic or optimistic. Just
no, I mean, I am actually sort of optimistic, but I do think that, I think somebody like Jeffrey Sachs, for all of his good intentions, is a man of the past, okay? And you know, in a way, I just focus on him because in a way he kind of epitomizes the kind of old enlightenment mission that still needs to be redeemed, et cetera, for us to be morally responsible human beings. While I appreciate this, and I was raised with it, and I do kind of, and at an instinctive level, I believe it, I believe the time has passed, and there's a sense in which the normative position has to be set somewhere else, and we do need to reinvent and preserve as much as what he's talking about as possible, but we're not going to be able to preserve the whole thing. We're not going to be able to provide safe water and food for everyone around the world. It's not going to happen. I'm sorry, it's not going to happen, but there's something valuable about trying to do that that in some way needs to be reinvented in some form. And that's where I am with this, okay? Because I do think part of the lazy discourse, I mean, I consider myself a person of the left, and I do think part of the lazy discourse of the left is to always drag out, you know, there are all these poor people in the world, and, you know, we haven't attended to them yet, and so why are we so focused on our own problems, et cetera, et cetera? It's not going to happen. We got to move to a different goal, a different sensibility. I mean, and try to preserve as much as is valuable there. But we've got to move on. And that's why I'm always, you know, I see Jeffrey Sachs came to Bristol, which is a medium-sized British city. He had 800 people in attendance. They loved him. They clapped. They screamed. It was like a revival meeting in the United States, okay? And you know, as soon as you see some people react like that, it has no impact. It's just it's like catharsis. You feel like you feel like somehow you've purged yourself from having to live the rest of your life when you're completely ignoring those goals. Yeah, that's why I call him a preacher, right? In the worst sense. He's a preacher in the worst sense. And I think we got to move away from that if we're going to be able to talk about normative ideals in some kind of responsible way. I'm not saying it's going to be easy. It's going to be tough. But, you know, we've got to do that. Jeffrey Sachs is a man of the past. I know, Bill, you have your hand, but you had your hand up a long time ago.
No, I was just commenting that you assume that evolution is such will change many things. But still, in our evolutionary structure, we have empathy. All primates and elephants have empathy.
But we have empathy with those with whom we are in normal contact.
So,
but we're not in normal contact with people in Sudan, and that's the problem.
Well, but these people have, through upper bricks for the Maslow pyramid, they are not producing as much as they were. Our population will peak in 2050. What happens then?
Yeah.
And they might have all computers, but I mean, this is very important. They change the revolution.
Yeah. No, I'm not trying to be completely pessimistic. So, you know, in criticizing somebody like Jeffrey Sachs, you know, it's not that I'm against everything. I do think some of the stuff he's saying does get realized, But I do think as an overarching goal for how to think of ourselves and how to make moral judgments of ourselves as a species, I think in a way it's not helpful. We should be about something else ultimately, even if what you're saying turns out to be true.
It seems.
My question was just, who is we?
Yeah,
well, at the moment, it's we in this room, you future leaders of the world. You know, you're set on universities, right?
You're going to be governing everything before you know. I mean, in a sense, that is why I like to give the talk. I like to give a talk of this sort to you people, right? Because you're the people who might be in some position to do something about some of this, in terms of shaping the images, you know, in terms of being the decision makers and things of that kind. I don't consider this to be a representative body of all the people who might be affected by anything by this. So to answer your question, I guess that's kind of what you're getting at, right? Right? There are all these people who might want to be in the room and have something to say about it. No, it's true. I'm talking to elites here.
Yeah. We those have computers. Or
yeah.
Those have dirty water and no food.
Yeah.
Well, I hate to say it, but people are
outside.
Okay.
Well,
you have to talk about.
This is why I'm advancing humanity.
Yes.
What on earth is humanity, in your sense?
Well, no, but this is the issue. Because the issue, in a sense, with regard to this point that's being made here, is does humanity require that we maintain our biological bodies that are given to us through evolution or whatever as long as possible? Or does it make sense, perhaps, to move into some other kind of medium? You know, what is it that constitutes our humanity? Is it tied directly to our biology? And I think the answer tends to be no now.
What is humanity? And who belongs
to it? Well, no, but this is, yeah, I know. I mean, it's an open question, so I think the question is more open than it's ever been before.
I don't
know.
I was just saying that.